small and ignorant. Result, the Eloi. And the undergrounders? I dared not suspect. But from what I had seen of the Morlocks, I could envision that their mutation was profound. The separation of labor and capital had become so acute, so institutionalized, that it altered the very genetic makeup of the human race. That night, I did not sleep well. Once or twice, I had a feeling of intense fear. Perhaps I should be afraid of the Morlocks, too. It occurred to me that in the next few nights, the moon would pass through its last quarter, and the nights would grow darker. And then, doubtless, these unpleasant creatures from below, these whitened lemurs, this new vermin would be more bold and more abundant. However, they held my time machine, and whether I liked it or not, I would have to go in after it. Oh, if only I had a companion. But in this world of weakness, I was so horribly alone. Next morning, I resolved I would make the descent into the Morlocks' domain without further waste of time. I started out towards a well near the ruins. Little Wiener ran after me. She danced beside the well, but when she saw me lean over its opening and look down, she gave a most piteous cry.
No!
Wiener, you mustn't be afraid of what you don't know. If the Morlocks are your servants, they are not to be feared. They are to be kept at bay, but not feared. Don't you realize that?
The Morlocks!
I shook her off, and in a moment was climbing down the shaft, perhaps 200 yards deep, my feet gaining purchase on metallic bars projecting from the sides. These being adapted to the needs of a creature much smaller and lighter than myself, I was cramped and soon fatigued by the descent. One of the bars bent under my weight and almost swung me off into the blackness. For a moment, I hung by one hand, and then I regained my footing. I did not dare rest again. The thudding sound of a machine below grew louder and more oppressive. When I looked up again toward the sky, Wiener had disappeared. At last, I saw dimly coming up a slender passage at a right angle to the wall. Swinging myself in, I found it was a narrow horizontal tunnel in which I could rest. The unbroken darkness had a distressing effect upon my eyes. The air was full of the throb and hum of machinery pumping air down the shaft. I do not know how long I lay there. Perhaps I napped. I was aroused by a soft hand touching my face. I grabbed for my matches, and quickly striking one, I saw three white creatures hastily retreating into the fetid gutter. This time I saw them more clearly. Living as they did in the impenetrable darkness, their eyes were abnormally large and sensitive. I have no doubt they could see me in that rayless obscurity. Worse, they did not seem to have any fear of me. Apart from the light. The place was stuffy and oppressive, and a faint scent of freshly shed blood hung in the dank air. My eyes were adjusting to the light so that my match cast its glow farther than I anticipated. As I crawled along the tunnel, I came upon an immense cavern. On its floor, far below, was a table of white metal, laid out with what seemed to be a meal. The food had the unmistakable glisten of meat. So the Morlocks were carnivorous. I wondered what large animal could have survived the eons to furnish the red flesh I saw in the flickering light of my match. It was all so indistinct. The heavy smell, the big unmeaning shapes, the obscene figures lurking in the shadows and only waiting for the darkness to come at me again. When the match burned down and stung my fingers, I dropped it, and there it lay, a glowing, dying red spot in the recovering blackness. How ill-equipped I was for this experience. I had started with the time machine on the absurd assumption that the men of the future would be infinitely ahead of ourselves. I had come without weapons, without medicine, even without enough matches, of which only four remained. As I stood in the dark. A hand brushed against mine. Lank fingers came feeling over my face. I turned, and they withdrew. I heard the breathing of a crowd of those beings around me. I felt the box of matches being taken out of my hand. I shouted at them as loudly as I could. They started away, and then they clutched at me more boldly, whispering odd sounds to each other. They tried to drag me back. I struck another match and waved it in their dazed faces. You cannot imagine how nauseatingly inhuman they looked. Those pale, chinless faces and great, lidless eyes. When my second match ended, I struck a third and retreated. It had almost burned out when I reached the opening of the shaft. As I felt for the hooks above me, my feet were grabbed from behind, and I was violently tugged backward. Scrambling, I lit my last match, and it went out. But I had my hand on the climbing bars now, and kicking violently, I freed myself from the clutches of the Morlocks. I sped up the shaft, while they all stayed behind, peering and blinking up at me, squinting in pain at the light from the surface. I staggered out into the sunlight and I fell to the soil. It smelled sweet and clean. I, however, felt dirty. The odor of rot and bile still stung my nose. I had seen both faces of the future, and they filled my heart with pity and fear. And then I remembered Weena. Before I ventured into the pit, I had held hope of finding my time machine. Now I felt like a beast in a trap. Now I understood the reason for the fear the upper world people had for the night. The Morlocks dared venture above ground only during a new moon, when the night is blackest. What foul villainy might it be that the Morlocks did when they could see best and the Eloi could see least? I realized that the moon was waning and that I had 2 or 3 days at most to fashion weapons. I would also have to find a place to sleep safely. For surely the Morlocks, judging by their wells, were dexterous climbers. As I looked for refuge, Weena accompanied me, and as was her game, innocently used my pockets as a kind of vase for floral decorations. As I explored the countryside with Weena, seeking safety, I fancied I could even feel the hollowness of the ground beneath my feet. Could indeed almost see through it to the Morlocks scurrying below, waiting for the dark. Weena's fatigue grew upon her. I took her in my arms. Then, as the night embraced us, she put her arms around me. We stopped at the edge of some woods, and she slept. Looking up at the stars suddenly dwarfed my own troubles. I thought of the Eloi and the Morlocks, and of how they must have forgotten their shared ancestry, and how man, as we knew him, had been swept out of existence. Then I was hungry, and for some reason, connected it with the great fear that existed among the Eloi. I shivered before I even knew why, and then I broke into a sweat. For the first time, I realized what the meat I had seen below might be. The Eloi were the fatted cattle which the Morlocks tended and preyed upon. What else could it be? At some time in the track of human decay, the Morlocks' food would have to have run short. The beasts of the field, as provided so generously in the Bible, had run their course. Possibly the Morlocks had lived for a time on rats or other vermin. Or perhaps man's prejudice against human flesh is not a deep-seated instinct after all. All the while, Weena slept beside, unable to conceive of her fate. Somehow, the Eloi knew to fear the Morlocks, but not why. The night passed. Come morning, I awakened Weena, and we found fruit to break our fast. As we walked through the woods, I pondered my course of action. First, to procure some new means of fire, for nothing I knew would be as efficient against the Morlocks as fire. And then I needed to arrange some contrivance to break open the doors of the White Sphinx to reclaim my time machine. As for Weena, I resolved to bring her with me, back to our own time. Weena led me to the Palace of Green Porcelain, that great abandoned building hearkening to an equally abandoned age, and we entered. The material of the palace proved on examination to be indeed porcelain, and along the face of it I saw an inscription. This writing, have you any idea what it says?
I have never seen such markings. They are very pretty designs.
They're not just designs. They're something called writing. Do you know what writing is?
No.
It's a way of recording words and ideas so that others may know them, even if you are not there to say it to them.
If you are not there, how can you say anything?
Writing is used for ideas. Thoughts, abstractions, memories, history. Oh, Weena, have you any concept of the past? Can you or your people possibly conceive of what has brought you to this point? Of all the precious knowledge of the ages that has slipped away forever? Oh, what's the use? Alas, the idea of writing had never entered Weena's head. As the great library of Alexandria was lost to us in our time, so was the sum of human knowledge since then lost to the Eloi. And perhaps it was Weena's simple affection that made her seem more human than she really was. Inside the doors of the Palace of Green Porcelain, Weena led me to what might have been in some time immemorial, a museum. The huge barrel skeleton of a brontosaurus greeted us in an immense rotunda. Around the rotunda were rows upon rows of display cases. Clearing away the thick dust from the glass cases, and judging from the way the contents had been preserved so perfectly, I suspected they might have been airtight. The hall was very silent, and to judge from the size of it, this palace of green porcelain was a great deal more than a museum. Possibly, it might even have been a library, although it had passed out of all recognition. Whatever devices the curators of this academy had used to convey language, they were as much a mystery to me now as this brontosaurus skeleton must have been to the first man who unearthed it. With Weena leading me, I entered another gallery and presently recognized the decaying vestiges of books. They had long since dropped to pieces, and every semblance of print had left them. Had I been a literary man, I might have moralized about the futility of all knowledge. But all that struck me was the enormous waste of labor to which this wilderness of rotting paper testified.
John.
Weena. You used my name.
There is more. Here. Come. You, come.
Where? Is it more writing?
No writing. Pictures.
Pictures?
Come.
Weena led me into a corridor beyond the main hall, and there I saw row upon row of what looked like silvered glass, almost mirrors. As I got closer, however, I saw that they did not reflect my image. They held an image of their own, and it moved. As I walked past the mirrors and stared at them in turn, I saw what was now the past, chronicle of time transpired, and they spoke to me.
With the enshrinement of knowledge came prosperity. No longer would superstition divide mankind. With great bounty came a great peace. Institutions fell not because they were toppled, but because they had fulfilled their purpose and yielded to the greater good.
Prosperity? Knowledge? But when? Could it have been that mankind will enter an age of enlightenment that lasted so long that dates will be meaningless?
And yet the seed of religion survived to flower again. This time, it embraced not a deity, but a new spirituality built upon the discarded belief of the old. Whatever inspires man to dream, he is bound to awaken to reality.
Give me a date, dammit! When did these things happen?
The new faith sanctioned a value placed upon all living things, rendering some higher and some lower. This piteous division of utility created an ever-widening discrepancy between those who shape the world to their own needs and those whose world is shaped by others. The two factions were driven farther and farther apart.
When did the bifurcation begin? How long ago? What good's a museum without years?
Mankind held its own place until nature herself rebelled. Not from without, but from within the human organism itself. With a terrible plague. Nation by nation. Species by species. Its onset so subtle that it took hold before anyone knew to stop it. Not one.
I was about to grab the nearest object and smash the mirror into bits when I saw one with columns of numbers running across it. I fancy myself comfortable with numerals, but these were beyond even me. Fortunately, its words were not.
As cycles came and went in groupings of 10,000 years, the sixth ice age receded, leaving behind denuded landscape and four continents. By the 400th millennium, the genetic separation was irrevocable. Occasional mutations proved the rule, rather than overturned it. Separated into Eloetus humanus and Morlachus dishumanus, the former Homo sapiens left no genetic trail by AD 492,965.
Well, give thanks to reason for something approaching a specific date. 400,000 years and counting. Counting backward.
As for the deoxyribonucleic acid, a double helix assaulted by centuries of environmental disparity, untangled and...
Whatever power drove the playback machinery was suddenly cut off. A scuffling noise came from the far end of the hall. A dark, windowless expanse. Were we being lured by the Morlocks? I had an idea. I grabbed Rena and turned to a machine from which projected an iron lever not unlike a crowbar. Grasping the rod in my hands, I put all my weight upon it sideways. It snapped off. And now, I had a mace that would be more than sufficient, I judged, for any Morlock skull I might encounter. And I longed so very much to kill a Morlock. So very inhuman, you may think, to want to go killing one's own descendants, but it was impossible to feel any humanity toward those creatures. Only my reluctance to leave Rena and my need to reclaim my time machine restrained me from going straight down into the wells and killing the brutes one by one. Instead, we stayed in the areas of the museum lighted by the afternoon sun. Going up a staircase, we came to what must have been a gallery of technical chemistry. The gallery was well preserved. And in an unbroken case, I found a box of matches. Stand back, Rena. Here's a taste of what I'll give the Morlocks. In short order, the matches were mine. Very eagerly, I tried one, and they were perfectly good. They were sealed with a container of camphor, which was also still functional. Now, with the iron crowbar and matches, I had weapons against the horrible creatures we both feared. We emerged from the palace. The sun was disappearing below the horizon. I was determined to reach the White Sphinx the next morning, but it was on the other side of the forest, as well as the other side of the night. When we paused from our walking, I felt that armed with matches and camphor, I could keep a torch blazing long enough to hold our own against the dwindling moon. For centuries, man had used oil-based camphor to light his caves. How ironic. that we should need it to light the encroaching night. I don't know if you've ever thought what a rare thing flame must be to men who don't know how to control it. In an age when the art of fire-making had been forgotten on Earth, the red tongues that licked up from the torch were an altogether new and strange thing to Weena. She wanted to play with it. I believe she would have grabbed the flames if I'd not pulled her away. As we walked, at first I heard no sounds save the crackling twigs under our feet and the faint rustle of the breeze above. After a time, however, the torch died down, and I had to renew the camphor on its tip. And then I seemed to sense a presence about us. I pushed on grimly. The pattering grew more distinct, and I caught the same strange sounds I'd heard in the underworld. Several Morlocks were tracking us, not daring to approach. As I led Weena through the shadows of the night, I would pass a tree and feel a tug at my coat, and then something on my arm, something reaching from the shadows. Weena shivered violently, and I held her tightly as we both became quite still. Again, the torch flickered. The camphor was showing its age. It was time for a match to relight the torch. But to get to one, I had to let Weena go. I did so, and as I fumbled in my pocket in the dark, I felt gnarled hands creep over my back and touch my neck. I spread a new wad of camphor on the torch and lit the match, and I saw the Morlocks fleeing behind the trees. I looked at Weena in the bright light. She was lying, clutching my feet, and quite motionless with her face to the ground, quivering in terror. I stooped to her. She seemed scarcely to breathe. I lifted her to my shoulder and pushed on, and then came a horrible realization. In maneuvering with my matches and Weena, I had turned myself about several times, and now I had not the faintest idea in what direction lay the Sphinx. Lost in the woods, like a child. I had to think rapidly what to do. Rather than risk wandering deeper in the forest, I decided we should encamp where we were and build a fire. I began collecting sticks and leaves. Just beyond the edge of the torchlight, I could see the Morlock's eyes shining like cold, lifeless stones, waiting for the fire to go out again. And suddenly, it did. The camphor had lost its light. I lit another match, and two white forms that had been reaching for Weena pulled back their arms and dashed hastily away, peering out from behind a tree. The camphor caught fire again, and the Morlocks were so blinded by the sudden light that one of them dashed straight for me, and I felt his bones grind under the blow of my fist. Soon I had a fire started. Weena was safe beside me, and the enemy was at bay. I looked at Weena in the flickering light and wondered what she would think once I brought her back to my era and civilization. I closed my eyes for just a moment when I felt rough hands on my face, and I woke with a start and stared a Morlock in the eyes. I had fallen asleep and let the fire go out. I hastily reached for the matchbox in my pocket. It was gone. They closed in and they grabbed at me. I grabbed Weena and we began to run. Who knew which direction we fled? We glanced off of trees, the branches tearing at our eyes. The forest was strange to us and pitch black, but the Morlocks had no trouble seeing, and they chased us relentlessly. The human rats where I judged their faces might be. I could feel the crunching of flesh and bone. I knew that both Weena and I were lost if I tired, but I was determined to make the Morlocks pay for their meat. I stood with my back against a tree, my club at the ready, and I heard them swarming, but none came within reach. And then suddenly, I saw a strange thing, and with it came hope. The darkness seemed to grow luminous. Very dimly, I began to see the shapes of the Morlocks about me. They covered their eyes and started running madly away through the wood. As I stood agape, I saw a little red spark go drifting across a gap of starlight between the branches. The smell of burning wood reached my nostrils. I looked through the black pillars of the nearby trees and saw in the distance the flames of the burning forest. It was my fire coming after me. Somehow, an old spark, an ember, had set the woods ablaze, and we were safe. And with that, I turned to Weena, and she was nowhere near me. I searched the surrounding bush, but found nothing. And then I happened to glance down and see the garland of flowers she'd been carrying. They were crushed in the dirt. One of two things could explain what had happened. Either Weena had met her death in the flames, or she was now in the bloody hands of the Morlocks. And now I was to see the most horrible thing of all those I beheld in that future age. The whole forest was burning with the light of the fire. Flames completely encircled the hillock, and in the clearing were some 30 or 40 Morlocks, dazzled by the light and scalded by the heat, blundering against each other in the bewilderment. Angrily, I rushed toward them, my crowbar swinging. At first, I didn't understand their blindness in the light, and I swung at them in fury. But when I watched them groping against the red sky and heard their moans, I realized their misery, and I attacked no more of them. Thrice I saw Morlocks put their heads down in confused agony and rush helplessly into the flames. But at last, above the subsiding red glow of the fire, above the streaming masses of acrid smoke and the blackening tree stumps and the diminishing numbers of these dim creatures, came the first rays of the morning sun. In the smoky dawn, I searched in vain for Weena amongst the cooling embers. If the Morlocks had in fact captured her, their panic last night would have made them leave her poor little body in the forest. I cannot describe how it relieved me to think that she had escaped the awful fate to which her fellow Eloi seemed destined, even if her fate in the flames was equally horrible. From the summit of my hillock, I could now make out, through a haze of smoke, the palace of green porcelain. And from that, I could get my bearings to find the White Sphinx. And so, leaving the remnant of those damned souls behind me, I tied some grass about my feet and limped across smoking ashes and among blackened stems that still pulsated internally with fire towards the hiding place of the time machine. As I left the forest once again for the White Sphinx, my loneliness returned, made more intense for the loss of Weena. And then I made a discovery. In my trouser pocket were still some loose matches. The box must have leaked before it was lost. About midday, I entered the clearing from which I had first viewed the world upon the evening of my arrival. The clearing on which hundreds of thousands of years earlier had stood this house in which we tonight are sitting. I thought of my hasty conclusions upon the evening and could not refrain from laughing bitterly at my confidence. Here was the same beautiful scene, the same abundant foliage, the same splendid palaces and magnificent ruins, the same silver river running between its fertile banks. There was the place where I had saved Weena, and that suddenly gave me a keen stab of pain. Like blots on the landscape rose the entrances to the underworld, and I understood now what all the beauty of the overworld people covered. The Eloi were moving about among the trees, bathing in the water, as they had when I first encountered them. Very pleasant was their day, as pleasant as the days of the cattle of the field. Like the cattle, they knew of no enemies and provided against no needs, and their end was the same. I grieved to think how brief the dream of the human intellect had been. It had committed suicide. It had set itself toward comfort and ease, a balanced society with security and permanency as its watchword. It had attained its hopes, only to come to this at last. Once, the rich had become assured of wealth and comfort, and the toiler assured of a life of work. No doubt, In that perfect world, there'd been no unemployment problem, no social question left unsolved, and a great quiet had followed. There is no intelligence when there's no change and no need of change. The only animals that partake of intelligence are those that have to meet a huge variety of needs and dangers. And so the upper world man had drifted toward his feeble prettiness, and the underworld to a mere mechanical industry. Apparently, as time went on, the feeding of the underworld had become disjointed. Mother Necessity, who had been staved off for a few thousand years, came back again, and she began below. When other meat failed them, the Morlocks turned to what habit had hitherto forbidden. So, that was my view of the world of 802,701. It may be as wrong an explanation as mortal wit could invent. It is, however, the way it shaped itself to me, and gentlemen, I give it to you. No.
Oh, I'm so sorry, my friend.
And yet, imagine the irony. Think of it, Philby. I miss a person who, as we all sit here, isn't even born yet.
Eloy. Morlocks. Cannibalism. What a depressing future you lay out for us.
Only if the future is set in stone, James. But suppose it isn't. What if everything we do today has some effect on what follows? Perhaps massive. Perhaps infinitesimal.
Or suppose the future has already happened and lies ahead waiting for us.
Or perhaps none of that. How the devil will we ever know?
Exactly, Samuel. The point is that we have the curiosity to ask.
Well, I'm asking.
Then you're interested in how I got back?
Among other things.
Really, Samuel?
It's all right, Philby. You may be comforted to see that I did get back, but not before yet another mind-boggling adventure. From the garden where I first arrived in the future, I walked to the pedestal of the Great Sphinx. And then came a most unexpected thing. As I approached the pedestal, I found its bronze doors open. They had slid down into grooves. Inside, on a raised place in the corner, was the time machine. I still had its control lever in my pocket. So here, after all my elaborate preparations for the siege of the White Sphinx, was a meek surrender. I threw my iron bar away, almost sorry not to use it again. I stepped up to the time machine and was surprised to find it had been carefully oiled and cleaned. I have suspected since that the Morlocks had even tried taking it apart, trying in their dim way to grasp its purpose. And then, the thing I expected happened. The bronze panels suddenly slid up and struck the frame with a clang. I was in the dark. Trapped. Or so the Morlocks thought. At that, I chuckled gleefully. I could also hear their murmuring laughter as they came towards me. Very calmly, I took one of the matches from my pocket. But I had overlooked one little technicality. The matches were of that kind that light only on the box. All my calm vanished. The little brutes were close upon me. One touched me. I made a sweeping blow in the dark at them with the lever and began to scramble into the saddle of the machine, trying to fit the lever into the control slots. Then came one hand upon me and another. I had to fight against their persistent fingers for the lever and at the same time feel for the stud to reattach it. Once, indeed, they made me drop it, and I had to butt in the dark with my head. I could hear the Morlock's skull ring. It was a nearer thing than the fight in the forest, this last scramble. But at last the lever was fixed, and I pulled it over. The clinging hands slipped from me. darkness presently fell from my eyes. I found myself in the same gray light and tumult I've already described, and I was again plummeting through time. What I did not notice was that instead of going back, I was careening headlong into the future. As I drove on, a peculiar change crept over the appearance of things. The palpitating grayness grew darker. And then, though I was still traveling at a prodigious speed, the blinking succession of day and night grew slower, until it seemed to stretch into centuries. At last, a steady twilight brooded over the earth. A twilight only broken now and then when a comet streaked across the darkening sky. Soon, there was only a solid evenness, and I perceived that the earth had come to rest with one face toward the sun. Very cautiously, I began to slow down, until the thousands of passing years seemed motionless, until the dim outlines of a beach grew visible. I stopped, very gently. The sky was no longer blue. Northeastward, it was inky black. And out of the blackness shone brightly and steadily the pale white stars. Overhead it was a deep Indian red and starless. The sparse vegetation looked like no more than moss, incapable of supporting animal life, if indeed such thing as life still existed. The world was no more than perpetual twilight. There was a sense of oppression in my head, and I noticed that I was breathing very fast, as one would do when mountaineering. From that, I judged the air to be far thinner than it is now, and rife with a tinge of ozone. Far away, up the desolate slope, I heard a harsh scream, and I saw a thing like a huge white butterfly go slanting and fluttering up in the sky, and circling, disappear over some low mountains beyond. The sound of its voice was so dismal that I shivered. Looking round me again, I saw that quite near, what I had taken to be a reddish mass of rock was moving slowly towards me. And then I saw the thing was really a monstrous, crab-like creature. Can you imagine a crab as large as a table? It stalked me, its many legs moving slowly and uncertainly, its big claws swaying, its long antennae like whips, waving and feeling, its dark eyes gleaming. Slowly, slowly it moved. No real threat, but nonetheless a paralyzing curiosity. Its back was corrugated and ornamented with ungainly bulges, and a greenish incrustation blotched it here and there. I could see the many parts of its complicated mouth flicking as it moved. As I stared at this sinister apparition crawling toward me, I felt a tickling on my cheek, as though a fly had lighted there. I tried to brush it away with my hand, but in a moment it returned, and almost immediately came another on my ear. I struck at this and caught something thread-like. It was drawn swiftly out of my hand. With a frightful qualm, I turned, and I saw that I had grasped the antennae of another monster crab that stood just behind me. Its evil eyes were wriggling in their stalks, its mouth was all alive with appetite, and its vast, ungainly claws, smeared with a slime, were descending upon me. In a moment, my hand was on the lever again, and I had placed a month between myself and these monsters, but I was still on the same dead beach as I stopped. Dozens of the monstrous crabs seemed to be crawling among the fields of intense green. I cannot convey the sense of desolation that hung over the world. I moved on. 100 years into the future, and there was the same red sun, a little larger, a little duller, the same dying sea, the same chill air. So I traveled, stopping ever and again, in great strides of 1,000 years or more, drawn on by the mystery of the Earth's fate. I alone watched with strange fascination the life of the Earth ebb away. At last, More than 30 million years hence, the huge red-hot dome of the sun had come to obscure nearly a tenth part of the darkening heavens, and then I stopped once more. For the red beach seemed lifeless. It was flecked with white. A bitter cold assailed me. White flakes came floating down. To the northeastward, the glare of everlasting snow lay under the starlight of a sable sky. There were fringes of ice along the sea margin, with drifting masses farther out. The stars in the sky were intensely bright and twinkled no more. Suddenly, I noticed that the circular westward outline of the sun had changed. That concavity, a bay, had appeared in the curve. For a minute, perhaps, I stared aghast at this blackness that was creeping over the day, and then I realized that an eclipse was beginning. Either the moon or the planet Mercury was passing across the sun's disk. Naturally, at first, I took it to be the moon. But there's much to incline me to believe that what I really saw was the transit of an inner planet passing very near to the Earth. The darkness grew apace. A cold wind began to blow in freshening gusts from the east, and the showering white flakes in the air increased in number. From the edge of the sea came a ripple and whisper. Beyond these lifeless sounds, the world was silent. Silent? It would be hard to convey the stillness of it. One by one, the distant peaks vanished into blackness. The shadow of the eclipse crept toward me, and the sky was absolutely black. A horror, this great darkness came on me. I felt I was fainting, but a terrible dread of lying helpless in that remote and awful twilight sustained me while I climbed back into the time machine. And so, I came back here. As I sped back to our time, the blinking succession of days and nights resumed. The sun got golden again, the sky blue. I breathed with greater freedom. Presently, when the million dial was at zero, I slackened speed. I began to recognize our own architecture. The hands of my gauge ran back to the starting point. The old familiar walls of the laboratory came around me, and very gently now, I slowed the mechanism down, and I stopped. For several minutes, I trembled violently, and then I became calmer. I nearly slept. Had I slept, I might have fancied the whole journey had been a dream. But wait. I had started my trek from the southeast corner of the laboratory. I had come to rest in the northwest. That is the exact distance from my little lawn to the inside of the White Sphinx, into which the Morlocks had dragged my time machine. Presently, I got up and came into this house. I saw the newspaper upon the table and found the date was today. Looking at the timepiece, I saw the hour was almost 8 o'clock. I heard your voices and the clatter of plates. I hesitated. I felt so sick and weak. And you know the rest.
Well,
yes, we do.
Look, I know that all this sounds incredible to you. To me, the one incredible thing is that I'm here tonight, in this old familiar room, looking into your friendly faces and telling you these strange adventures. Well, what say you all? Well, say something, for God's sake.
Well, what do you want us to say?
Take it as a lie or a prophecy. Say I dreamed it in the workshop, and taking it as a tale, what do you think of it? Samuel, you're always the most skeptical.
And I remain so. What a pity it is you're not a writer.
James, you bid me continue. Now that you've heard my adventure, are you more convinced than Samuel?
Of course I am, if you say so.
You don't believe it?
Well, I believe that you believe it.
Oh, to tell you the truth, I hardly believe it myself. And yet, here, look at these flowers, Colin.
Why? They're extraordinary.
Weena gave them to me when we were in the woods. She collected them and stored them in my waistcoat pockets.
I don't believe I've ever seen a specimen like it.
And I would lay odds that you'll not find them in any botanical book today. They were a gift from Weena. In the future.
Would you mind if I took them in for research?
I would very much mind. They're all I have of her. All that can prod my memory. My memory of things yet to come.
What's the time? Well, I'll be hanged if it isn't midnight. The trains have stopped by now. How shall we get home?
Well, there'll be plenty of cabs at the station.
Yes, of course. Thank you, Mrs. Watchett. Mm. You're the one dependable element of this household.
Mm. Dependable for dinner every Thursday, that's for sure, Mr. Samuel.
Oh, much more than that, ma'am. Much more. Good night, then.
Good night, sir. Good night, gentlemen.
Good night. Good night.
Mind the front steps.
Yes. Thank you.
Thank you for dinner.
Good night, John.
Good night.
Coming, Philby?
Well, I think I'll stay back a minute. I want to speak with John.
Good night, then.
Well, good night, John.
Good night.
Good night, Philby. Sir.
Good night, Colin, and you too, Samuel and James.
Good night.
Good night.
Will you be needing me any more tonight, sir?
No, Mrs. Watchett. I suspect Mr. Philby has a few more questions to ask me in private. I'll see to the downstairs.
Well, good night, then.
Good night.
Oh, good night.
Good night, Mrs. Watchett.
Thank you again. The flowers, John. Tell me again, where did you really get them?
I told you. They were put into my pocket by Weena when I traveled into time.
I can see that you miss her terribly.
Yes. And yet, as I stare around this room, I wonder, did I ever know her? Did I ever make a time machine or even the model of a time machine?
I saw them both with my own eyes, and they did seem real. But right now, I'm more concerned about your health. Finish your meal, John, and have yourself a good night's sleep and pleasant dreams.
They say that life is a dream, Philby, and a precious poor dream at times. But where did that dream come from? Wait. I must see something.
Where are you going? John, where are you going?
To my machine. I must see it again.
Outside without a coat? It's the dead of winter.
Bring a lantern and come with me.
Oh, this is madness. Sheer madness.
I followed the time traveler outside. There in the flickering light was the machine, sure enough, squat, ugly, and askew. For all its travails, it was still solid to the touch. But I put out my hand and felt the rail, just the same. I saw brown spots and smears upon the ivory, bits of grass and moss upon the lower parts, and one rail bent awry. The time traveler put the lamp down and ran his hands along the damaged rail.
Well, it's all right now. The story is true. I'm sorry to have brought you out here in the cold.
Not at all. Now, let's leave it at that. You can attend to it tomorrow. After all, you have the time.
Yes. Truer words were never spoken, Philby. Good night.
Good night, my friend.
I left the house soon after, barely able to make sense out of my thoughts. The story was so fantastic and incredible. I lay awake most of the night thinking about it. I went the next day to see the time traveler again, only to be told by Mrs. Watchett that he was in the laboratory. The laboratory, however, was empty. I stared for a minute at the time machine and put out my hand and touched the lever. Just the barest touch, you understand. Even so, the device swayed like a bough shaken by the wind. Its instability startled me, and I had the odd memory of my childhood days when I used to be warned not to meddle. I came back into the house and found the time traveler in the smoking room. He looked as though he had slept as badly as I. He had a small camera under one arm and a knapsack under the other.
I'm sorry. I have no time to visit. I'm awfully busy.
Well, I've just come by for a moment. But John, tell me the truth now that we're alone. I mean, is this some sort of a hoax, or do you really travel through time?
Really and truly, Philby, I do.
Can I see you do it?
All right, then.
Oh, well, now, how do we do it?
No. Just give me half an hour. I know why you came, and it's awfully good of you. There's some magazines here, and if you'll stay for lunch,
I'll prove this time traveling to you, specimen and all. If you'll forgive me leaving you for 30 minutes.
Well, no, of course. I mean, I have the time.
Yes, well, good, good. And thank you for coming back, Philby. Whether you believe it or not, thank you. You're a good friend.
He nodded and went down the corridor. I heard the door of the laboratory slam, and I took up the daily paper to wait. What was he going to do before lunchtime? Then I remembered that I had promised to meet my publisher at 2. I looked at my watch, and I saw that I could barely make the appointment. So I got up straight away and went down the hall to tell the time traveler. As I took hold of the handle of the door, I heard an exclamation, oddly cut off at the end, and a click and a thud. As I opened the door, a gust of wind whirled around me, and from within came the sound of broken glass falling on the floor. But the time traveler was not there. I seemed to see a ghostly, indistinct figure sitting in a whirling mass of black and brass for a moment, a figure so transparent that the bench behind, with its sheets of drawings, was absolutely distinct. Then the time traveler was gone. At that, I understood. At the risk of disappointing my publisher, I stayed on, waiting for the time traveler, waiting for his next, perhaps even stranger story, and the specimens and photographs he would bring back with him. But I'm beginning to fear that I am to wait a lifetime. The time traveler vanished 3 years ago. As everyone knows, he has never returned. And I have by me for my comfort 2 strange white flowers, shriveled now, and brown, and flat, and brittle, to witness that even when mind and strength had gone, gratitude and mutual tenderness still lived on in the heart of man. Heard The Time Machine by H.G. Wells. Appearing with me was Leonard Nimoy as the Time Traveler, featuring in alphabetical order Roxanne Dawson, Richard Doyle, Robert Ellenstein, Marnie Moseman, Andrew Robinson, and Armin Shimmerman. Also with Keegan DeLancey and Owen DeLancey as the Eloy. Post-production supervisor, Jeff Howell. Editing and sound design by John Chiminski. Script supervisor, Scott Peterson. Original music score composed and performed by Peter Erskine and recorded at Puck Productions in Santa Monica, California. The script was written by Nat Sigaloff and directed by Jack Fletcher. The Time Machine is a copyrighted production of Alien Voices Incorporated. This is John DeLancey.
Time Machine is a Simon & Schuster audio presentation. Look for Alien Voices, Journey to the Center of the Earth, also available from Simon & Schuster Audio.